This is the third Bishop Cass's seminar of this year, which is sponsored by the Institution of Humanities at King's and the Institute of Classical Studies. There is lots of flyers here, I hope there'll be enough to go around, about various organisations that support this series of seminars. There's also a pile of programmes here, so by all means take one. Just one important point, as you can see, this is being recorded and will be podcast, so you're aware that when your voices go on the internet, you will have to be notified to you speaking if you actually say anything. So, anyway, I'd like to introduce Dr. Andy Bevan from the Institute of Archaeology at UCL, who will be giving us this seminar this afternoon. He'll be talking on computational approaches to human and animal movement in the archaeological record, and I think if you're talking for about 45 minutes and then time for questions afterwards. Sure. So, Andy.
Okay. When I was asked to come up with a topic for this seminar, I made the foolish decision that I'd try and maybe push the boat out a little bit, not do something that I'd done before, maybe tackle a topic that I was interested in, but I hadn't yet done enough research on. Of course, over the duration of two terms of teaching and then some marking thereafter, it kind of got lost in the mix a bit. So it really came to some fairly last minute analysis to try and pull together what I think is a really interesting topic, potentially. And hopefully enough of that interest will come through in what I'm going to say. Really, what I wanted to cover was why should we bother to model movement in the archaeological, or for that matter, the historical record, from a computational perspective. And I'll really cover a range of different domains of inquiry. First, tackle some of the methods that people use to model movement. How we might go about calibrating movement, I'll come back to what that means in a bit. Roots as landscape capital. How do we study roots? One way is to model them, another one would be to analyze them statistically. How roots and patterns of movement relate to the expression of territory in the archaeological record. What we mean when we talk about wayfinding, particularly wayfinding in unfamiliar environments, and how we might possibly get at it computationally. And the relationships that become a little bit more complex but extremely interesting. We talk about patterns of movement, patterns of wayfinding, territorial expression with respect to groups of people or groups of animals, so group dynamics. And I'll end with the obvious question related to a seminar such as this, which is how does that relate to classics and classical archaeology? What particular contribution can those set of disciplines make? So why model movement with computers? The disadvantages first. We struggle, particularly in archaeological context to actually reconstruct movement environments, whether we're talking about urban environments or larger landscape environments. So paleo landscapes, for example, where do we put the trees in those landscapes? Where do we put the swamps and that sort of thing? We can get probabilistic impressions of those issues. We can say this broad region is likely to be mixed oak forest in the past, or this is likely to be swampy. But if we're thinking about particular scenarios of movement, we can only suggest possibilities. We can't actually come up with definitives. We'll never put the trees back in their original place. And that would be a difference between a sort of virtual reality style reconstruction and one where you're trying to model things with a slightly more sort of predictive intent. Lack of clear cultural framework. How do we ascribe meaning to patterns of movement where those meanings are only embedded in sort of the material record that survives? So do we want to become sort of frustrated ethnographers in a sense, not quite understanding what those patterns of movement that we're trying to model are actually meaning? Are they being influenced by things like the precedent set by theoretical ancestors, the influence of personal and family relationships, certain particular meanings describe a particular journey, such as pilgrimages, that sort of thing. Also, the lack of a full sensory experience. We can't put back Visibility is something we can try and model. Visibility while moving is something that we're on the sort of cusp of being able to model a little bit more effectively. When we talk about smells and sounds, again, we're probably going to be dealing in some sort of probabilistic environment where we can say with some likelihood that this is going to be a noisy place or this is going to be a smelly place, but we're not going to be able to do so. So, what are those all disadvantages? It sounds a bit terrible to start with all the negatives, but the risk there is that when you start modeling movements in this sort of context, you are going to end up with what people always criticize with respect to computational modeling, some sort of highly deterministic, culture-free expression of things, something lacking any sort of cultural import, if you like. I don't think that's necessarily true, though. So to move on to some advantages. Modeling movement asks us to try and reconstruct past landscapes and to do so with a little bit more of an edge to it than if you're just trying to do it in a sort of non-moving environment. The typical type of reconstruction we get of landscapes are these static, god's eye view, top-down experiences. If you think about movement beyond, I'll take some very sort of overly simplistic models in a second, but beyond your sort of standard, where are the tracks, where are the trackways, or people are moving from north to south, then you're going to have to grapple with landscapes in a way which is unusual, and that's a good thing. We should be able to put numbers on hypothetical movement scenarios, and that's always useful because we want to cut down the range of possible explanatory variation that we've got. We don't necessarily want just a huge array of different possibilities when we try and explain people moving through a landscape or animals moving through a landscape or different movement strategies. We want to cut down on that variation. And quantifying things in a computer is one way of trying to do that, putting probabilities on it. When we use a computational environment, we're encouraged to be cross-disciplinary. And a lot of the cross-disciplinary evidence is numerical in nature, things like physiological experiments in terms of energy efficiency or speed of travel or a variety of other variables. And we can certainly aim to model those past contexts as well. The great thing about a computational environment is the repeatability. That's not something to sort of shy away from. And I'd say that a clear sort of thing that I want to carry through the entire talk today is that we really should be aiming for simple models of movement. Simple doesn't mean boring and it doesn't mean deterministic. It means that you're adopting a particular perspective on what computational modeling does. And the two extremes are a computer model should be trying to grasp the full range of reality, the full complexity of reality, on the one hand. So if you're modeling a city, you try and model everything, including every car that moves through and the little pigeons that fly around in the park and all of that sort of thing. And people certainly try that. There are cities in the United States that have been modeled at that level of realism. That's one option. The other option is to try and be highly simple in terms of your modeling, and use that as a heuristic tool and say, here's an extremely pared down version of events. Does it or does it not explain what's going on? And I definitely make a plea for the latter. A lot of the sort of full-on spatial statistics that people use for analyzing spatial phenomena, and it's certainly something that comes into archaeology as well, rely on as the crow flies distances implicitly. Now, for some people, this is not sort of their world, but for others, sort of highly interesting things like patterning of settlements and buildings and whether they're clustered or regularly spaced. There are a range of statistical tools which tell you about that in formal terms. Spatial statistics typically are as the crow flies distances implied. Think about nearest neighbor distances between sites. That's straight line distances. And of course, we could consider modeling movement to make those a little bit more sensitive to the fact that the real world doesn't operate always in terms of as the crow flies distances. So, that's a question. Do we want to make those models more complex by adding in sort of more sensitive terrain analysis? We'll come back to that. One way in which people approach movement outside of archaeology, outside of classics and history, is with respect to what you might call discrete networks, particularly in things like the delivery of parcels. You have a road system through the United States, and you want to find the most efficient or the most cost efficient or the most time efficient way of moving a set of parcels across the country and visiting a certain number of cities, but trying to do so maybe only once. That's typically known as the traveling salesman problem. And in those discrete networks where you've basically got nodes joined by lines, as they're called edges typically, there's an awfully big literature on that topic, and people have done a lot of work looking at the degree of clustering of nodes in a network, or the measures of betweenness between networks. Lee Isaacson has done some work, which I think was presented in Digital Classicist last year, which is now published, looking at those networks for Roman Vitica, which was a very interesting piece of work. So those discrete networks are one possible way of looking at movement. They can be more or less complex. You could deal with relationships that are isotropic. Movement either way is treated in the same manner, or anisotropic. Moving one way is not the same as moving the other. I'll come back briefly to network analysis at the end. The problem is, Leaf's work aside, that in many instances, it's a little bit difficult in the archaeological record, for example, to deal in discrete node-edge relationships. Typically, we model landscapes as well, and those landscapes are continuous fields of experience. And in that respect, we have to move away from this sort of network-oriented perspective and try something else. Another reason we might want to try and model movement in this manner is because there's some very interesting scenarios in sort of human history that we would like to think of as being spatially trended, if you like, in some way or another. Here's a classic one, which is being modeled in an incredibly limited spatial environment at the moment, but it's trying to model spread of farming, or in fact species diversity for periods of the Neolithic, out from a single source to the end of the run. But this is, in theory, supposed to be, it doesn't really look like it, it's supposed to be Europe. Anatolia, Northern Europe. Nice and simple. Nothing really spatial going on there, apart from this sort of gradual drift, in theory, from southeast to northwest. But the answers that you get from this sort of, the suggestions that you get from this sort of modeling are very interesting. They'd be far more interesting if they were modeled in a sort of more spatially explicit environment where movement conditions were a sort of stronger component. Traditionally, in archaeological GIS and elsewhere, one of the big, say from the beginning of the 90s onwards, one of the big deals was the ability to do this modeling of continuous fields of spatial variation. So cost surfaces, as they're known, and linked to those least cost paths, are the sort of one of the sort of flag bearers of the sort of movement studies from a computational perspective. And just to summarize, I won't dwell on cost surfaces for this entire talk, but they're worth addressing. Cost surfaces involve a 2 or 3 step process whereby you create a friction map, a surface which expresses the cost of moving across different cells in what is essentially a digital image, a raster data set more generically. Those costs can include things like the cost of different types of terrain, the cost of different vegetation cover. They could, in theory, although rarely do, involve things like measures of cultural influence. This is a taboo area of the landscape, and this is not a taboo area of the landscape, and they will involve different cultural costs, for example. And then you take that surface and you agree on a starting point and you spread out from that starting point. And that's accumulating the cost outwards, and it involves what's called a spreading algorithm, spreads out to a particular point of departure. If you're interested in surfaces from a particular point, and there's an example top right as you see it of Knossos in Crete, where it's a measure of hours travel out from Knossos. If you're interested in the surface itself, that's the end of your cross surface modeling. You've got some sort of chloroplect map of various distance bounds outwards from a particular site that you could use for various things. You could look at catchment modeling, or you could look at particular configurations of costs within a sort of sub-region of the island. Often, though, people are interested not just in a surface, but in some delineation of a route of movement as well. and a least cost path is the typical one which they create. Now that term deserves theoretical caging in a way it normally isn't. Least cost is very loose as a definition. It normally means some form of optimized cost with respect to a particular set of goals. So it might be minimizing time, so the least time to get to a particular location. But it could be minimizing anything you can think of. You set up this sort of modeling properly, you could be minimizing risk, you could be minimizing energy expenditure, you could be minimizing cultural offense, the degree to which people get angry at you. Of course, the experiments become a little bit more difficult to design under those conditions. People think of least cost paths and cost surfaces very much within the one tradition of modeling, the one where you're thinking you're trying to explain everything, that idea of a realistic reconstruction of an entire city, high-end modeling. In fact, much better at the opposite, which is producing some sort of expected background expectation, some expected pattern against which you find out all of the interesting things. You say, well, actually, this doesn't conform with some sort of standard measure of energetic costs or something, and therefore is far more interesting from a sort of analytical and interpretive perspective. And there are a range of different analyses that have looked at least cost paths in that way. Cost surfaces can be isotropic in the sense that the way they measure travel doesn't depend on direction. You can move across a square in any direction that costs the same amount. They can be partially anisotropic in the sense that you can model things like just the effect of a strong wind on a cyclist. The cyclist going one way is impeded. The cyclist going the other way is actually aided by that wind. Partially anisotropic case. Or fully anisotropic in the sense of directions of travel are entirely dependent on which direction you choose. So the costs of travel are entirely dependent on which direction you're going in. And the typical one is moving across terrain. Cost of moving up a slope is different from down a slope, is different from along the contour. Finally, another one is dynamic costs, far more rarely addressed. The degree to which those costs vary in time, and we'll come back to that, but there are certain key situations in which that's the case, and a good example is something like sailing seasons. Winds change from month to month. You'd have to model that dynamically if you wanted to do so effectively. Also, there are also good problems with this sort of modeling, which mean that people want to criticize it from the perspective of it being a little bit too deterministic in a variety of ways. That's one thing. But then I've got another hook on the people that which sort of snare people who are using this sort of approach, which is that there are all sorts of algorithmic issues associated with it and different choices in terms of the input parameters. Some of them have to do with the way in which you measure, recalibrate things like slope to imply cost. The fact that people allied so many different and very important different ways of understanding cost. People move in slightly different ways, so individuals are different from one another. It's important to retain some concept of that individuality. They have different fitness levels, they have different agendas in terms of what they want to do. Sometimes people are interested in minimizing things like energy expenditure, don't want to get too tired. Sometimes they're worried about walking speed, they want to go as fast as possible. Sometimes worried about injury, sometimes risk of detection, something like smugglers, or the opportunity for detection if you're wanting to go out there and sort of find lots of things to hunt, for example. These are all different potential costs. If you go out and read the cost surface literature, it's completely absent. People mainly deal in these first two, and typically they'll lump them together in some sort of very, very unclear way. There are also, I don't dwell on it, but there are all sorts of algorithmic issues beyond that as well. Things like that spreading algorithm works in a way it spreads out to different neighborhoods, and they create very false perspectives as they spread outwards. Because of the way in which a digital image or raster data set works, the cells constrain movement in particular ways. What you hope for, if you're spreading out on a flat plane, so if you're entirely flat plane and you're spreading algorithms moving out, you hope they create concentric circles. That would make sense, straight lines from A to B. In fact, it doesn't. It produces these faceted effects. So your straight line from A to B would actually be a dog leg in these models in many cases, and that's not at all satisfactory. And there are a bunch of other things that are, I won't dwell on now, but that's another reason why, from an initial period of sort of quite a lot of hype, cost surfaces are now sort of approached a little bit more circumspectly. However, all hope is not lost. There are a series of advances that have been made in terms of this type of modeling, which are extremely useful. For example, in one of the open source software packages for GIS called GRASS, there's a recently developed module, probably since about 2002, called R.Walk, which gets rid of some of the problems and ameliorates others associated with this type of analysis. First of all, it has the ability, unlike, I would say, any other, maybe bar one package out there, to model proper anisotropic costs, so direction-dependent costs. It works in a much simpler way with an elevation model rather than intermediary data sets. It's got a more complex algorithm which doesn't do this, but does something approaching sort of concentric circles on a flat plane, so it's a little bit better there. And it outputs things in meaningful units. It's explicit about what it's doing. It's saying, this is producing something associated with travel time, measured in seconds. A little bit more precise, but anyway, it's at least being explicit. And it's based quite clearly on some empirical work done by the Scottish mountaineer William Mason about cost of time cost of travel in mountainous environments. One thing people haven't really done very much of in a kind of systematic way is actually take these models out into the real world or with some historical data and test them. Do they produce the computed results that they're supposed to? Either in terms of the actual delineation of paths or at least in terms of the estimate of travel times. And I had a look at some travel times that were recorded by an early archaeologist, John Pendlebury, in the late middle 1930s. He did a series of walks between 60 different sites on Crete and measured the travel times between those. And of course, they're different in different directions in such a rugged landscape, so they're very explicitly, this is from Knossos to Plestos, and next time he'd say, well, this is from Plestos to Knossos. And that allows you to model, compare the anisotropic times of something like an R.Walk calculation to his estimated times and plot a correlation. And in general, correlation is extremely strong. And it's interesting where it falls over, really. It's really at a particular threshold, about there, maybe 8 hours, that you get a sort of slight underestimate on the part of the computer, which is interesting, because of course that's beyond a day's travel. And there are all sorts of logistical parameters in terms of rest periods, heavier loads for overnight stay, misobservation of times, or whatever. That come into play there. So the errors at that farther end actually say as much as the consistency at this lower end. And of course, you compare it to other types of GIS modeling and also to straight line distances to see whether you're getting any actual improved knowledge. Do we know more as a result of this? And in, at least in statistical terms, we do have, it suggests that this is significantly better. So, cost surfaces. More generally, I mentioned the problem of people eliding things like the effort involved in travel and the time involved in travel and other sorts of costs. Part of the problem is people haven't been very specific about who's doing the traveling. And that really does make it seem like it's just a clunky computer calculation, whereas in fact we should be breaking things down, differentiating them into agents of various sorts, being a little bit more explicit. So just to take some examples, where some work outside of classics and archaeology and outside of traditional GIS, some extremely good work's been done. It just hasn't hit the sort of mainstream of computation yet. Here's an example of somebody who looks at the physiology of humans and animals, particularly in this case horses, and tries to link it back to equine performance in a variety of different situations. Particularly looking in this case at the Persian Royal Road route that was set up with a particular set of staging posts and at particular distances. In fact, Xenophon mentions that this was done experimentally. Cyrus the Great explored horse and rider performance to see what would be the sort of best distances between staging posts. And in fact, not only well, in fact, they're very consistent cross-culturally. A variety of different sort of postal system, Pony Express style systems. And it probably reflects very specifically the particular physiology of horses, which is that they have sort of basically two speeds, if you like. They have a turbo speed and a non-turbo speed. They can either go at a particular sort of rate, which is a little bit more economical, or they can use a totally different sort of metabolic pattern, an anaerobic one, and it also involves a sort of a change in an emptying of the spleen, in fact, which releases red blood cells and extra oxygen and that sort of thing. And they can do that over short periods. And this is a plot of the very high-end performance of racehorses using that sort of approach over very short distances. This is the log distance scale. So up to maybe, well, who knows, about maybe a few kilometers of race distance, these horses go extremely quickly. Over longer distances, they go, they have a different sort of different way of traveling, if you like. Still at the gallop, but not really sort of extreme travel. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the consistency of, if you look at the distance between historically documented staging posts, they tend to fall in this gray band here, which is exactly on the edge between those two different patterns, if you like, with which horses move. And you can see that they're trying to basically maximize the top end of that sort of low-level pattern, because you don't want to risk injury, heat exhaustion, because then you want reliability, the message has to get through, but it wants to be at the high end of the right reliability scale. So that's, that gives you all sorts of potential for modeling things like postal systems in other contexts as well, although apparently the Roman cursus publicus is a little bit slower for a variety of reasons, I think, but it's still useful for modeling all sorts of situations. Other equids, don't want to dwell on it too much, but there are all sorts of patterning that is interesting associated with the movement of these other transport animals. For example, ox-eyed ingots in the Bronze Age looks as if they get standardized partly because they're handy to put in the holds of ships, they stack well, but partly because they strap to either side of a donkey efficiently. And 60 kilograms is the upper end of what a donkey will typically carry, so on either side. Donkeys, people have done quite a lot of work, haven't read it yet, it's here, I thought about reading it, and got it today. They're very, very economical in terms of energy expenditure. And it's probably worth trying to do the same sort of plotting in terms of looking at some very interesting donkey caravan routes that exist in the ancient world. Here's a great example, famous Tultepe tablets that tell you about huge Bronze Age trade network bringing tin and lapis lazuli all the way from Afghanistan up into the central Anatolian plateau via Ashur, these are Syrian merchants. And the classic thing is that A, we're fairly certain of the particular routes that they took, and they matched to a degree that Royal Persian Road. They went through Ashur and up this way, but the tablets allow us to also track change in the actual exchange ratio of different precious metals as you move along this route, and also things like the numbers of donkeys involved in particular caravans, where they were watered, what sort of scale of groupings were at Ashur itself and over here. So in terms of the economics, donkey economics, if you like, there's a whole range of things that can be played with there that haven't really been addressed yet in terms of routing, scale, and the structure of those trade regimes. Camels, another really important one in the ancient world, particularly towards the early medieval period. The rates are slightly different again. The parameters, if you're trying to model them from a movement point of view, are very different. The particular base rate, ability to travel for longer periods without water, for example. Typical caravans are in huge numbers, in some instances, thousands of camels together. There's some very, very good empirical evidence on things like the very huge, incredibly consistent rate of travel across quite long distances from, say, Aleppo to Basra in Iraq, a very good 18th century record of that, to the extent that this guy here, Reynolds, was suggesting in 1791 that they use the pace, the gait, the stride of a camel, and the distances they typically cover in a day, as a way of mapping Africa. Because if you sent out camel caravans in Africa, you could use their individual travel times to build an overall map. So there's a lot of potential to use that further. Llama's not really part of the classical world, except if you watch Troy, and at a limited point where Brad sits not in the scene, they show a couple of llamas wandering around the town, so classical by proxy. But some very interesting work shows the potential for how we could approach these sort of movement scenarios in a classical world as well. A guy called Niko Trigovic has been studying llama caravans, and of course they're camelids as well, and there are a lot of similarities in terms of camel movement. Things like what is the optimum slope on which they prefer to travel, and in fact it's much steeper than for humans. Humans is about 5 to 6 degrees, 8 to 9 degrees, llamas travel at their fastest. And you can plot, for example here, the average speed in relation to slope, and get some very strong empirical evidence. Also in terms of the scale of organization of the llama caravans. I talked about dynamic modeling of movement, and a classic situation would be something like paddling, rowing, or sailing. These are often thought of as generically faster ways of traveling in the ancient world than terrestrial journeys, but of course they're also quite unpredictable in a variety of ways. Currents, winds, that sort of thing are often difficult to predict. Canoes are different from sailing ships in terms of what options they give you. Flexible range of routes, but often short range in nature, and very low carrying capacity. Most of the space in a canoe whether it's a long canoe or a small canoe, is filled up with people rowing or paddling. Sailing ships are much better for bulk cargo, but you've got to wait for the right winds. And one key thing to make clear from a computational perspective is that people again tend to align or provide a synchronic account of sail ship performance across all periods, particularly drawing on classical records but also medieval records. And that's just not true. There are huge variations in the technology in terms of the ability to sail to different points of the wind, how you deal with coastal waters versus open sea sailing, that sort of thing, that change from the Bronze Age, third millennium, when they get introduced in the Eastern Mediterranean, through to classical period, the range of different rigging types and some of the reconstructions that we know best, through to the medieval period, where you get the emergence of things like lateen rigging and your sort of transatlantic voyaging. So need to be very careful about those sort of situations. I'll just briefly go and talk about how you might model territories from a movement perspective. Some very interesting work, again, outside of the sort of mainstream archaeological world, is on the evolution of trail systems. And the interesting thing is that if you talk about, take three points, how pedestrians create trails between them, well, often start off with a series of direct links, and that creates things like areas, patches of open grass, open sort of open trail where the vegetation is lower, so they become visible markers. People start following those rather than just taking their own preferred route. And as that happens, some of the trails degrade because they aren't used as much as others. And that eventually leads to what these authors have suggested is a bundling phenomenon, whereby you actually get some sort of situation of paths like this between three points, where the paths sort of meet in the middle, because it's that's the result of people slowly starting to follow the established paths already, and gradually they move into the center. So there's lots of interesting potential there with picking out existing visible observed paths in the archaeological record and trying to suggest what sort of evolutionary trajectory they've had. Are they that sort of those direct links or something different? Another thing that I've tried in the past is just to number crunch trackways across a large area. This is the Greek island of Kythra, which is taking a series of 19th century trackways and plotting them against the slope with a variety of questions in mind. One is just to see how prominent they are with different degrees of slope, and you can see here that they're pretty common. There's this probability of quite common until about sort of 10 to 12 degrees, and they start tailing off. They become less common, but that's sort of steepness. And increasingly less common down to steeper values. And all of this is a little bit full on statistical nerdery for today, but what it's trying to express is in fact something interesting, which is the windiness of tracks as you move up and down different terrain slopes of different steepness. And it models quite effectively that there's a strong signal through all of the noise of different tracks and when they're produced of winding happening at certain thresholds. As slopes get steeper, particularly from 12 degrees, then these routes tend to wind more aggressively. You get those dogleg, hairpin bend type trackways, and you get also less tracks. So a totally different movement environment gets created at about that threshold. And there are a range of other Mediterranean structures, such as terraces and field systems, that also have that relationship with about 12 degrees of slope. So it's an interesting way of scaling a sort of Mediterranean landscape. Movement scenarios are more consistent than people often think with respect to certain sorts of parameter cross-culturally. It's really impressive some of the work that people have done to assert this in situations that at first glance might seem entirely different. So for example, there's an awful lot of evidence now that the average total travel time of any given family or individual in a particular day is usually about 1 hour consistently across all cultures. There's obviously a bell curve around that. There's some people who travel more and some people who travel less than that. But typically, mean total travel time in a day is about an hour. And that's interesting because, of course, it cuts across all sorts of different travel technologies. So travel distances stretch out massively depending on travel, different time periods. Nowadays, with planes and new things like these maglev trains that transport people all along the conurbation of sort of Tokyo incredibly rapidly, the distances are huge, but the travel time stays roughly about the same. That seems like an intuitive thing that humans use as a way of sort of scaling their own activities, not to travel too much more than that. If you look at the size of individual village units and their territories in Greece, if you look at the distance to fields that farmers are comfortable to travel, typically it's always half that, there and back in a day, 2.5 kilometers, say, one way. And I was interested in that sort of way in which movement, human movement, configures territory with respect to some work that we've been doing on the island of Kithra, looking at the Bronze Age settlement pattern. Some scrubby pottery which signifies particular Bronze Age farmsteads in the landscape, and these are these orange farmsteads on one particular in one particular plateau area. Some work suggests that they actually equate to what you can see top right, which are a series of sort of Cretan farmsteads. They're little buildings, they're probably one family farmsteads. And they're spaced out quite regularly. You can see there's a sort of regular configuration to them. And interestingly, occasionally they've got a little tomb halfway between one another, which almost looks like they're marking out little territories, little land holdings, if you like. That sort of movement, that sort of territory, can be expressed a little bit more clearly in terms of different activity patterns. Things that go on immediately around the farmstead, such as agricultural processing, the types of broader agricultural practices that go on slightly further afield. And all of that, of course, smacks very strongly of what in archaeological terms has been named catchment analysis for a very long time. But I think we can sort of take it a little bit further these days if we try and think more clearly about movement patterns. And also we can analyze it in computational terms. So noted that regularity at the small scale in terms of the settlements, regular spacing between them. At a larger scale, they also actually tend to clump into slightly bigger clusters, maybe one there, one there, one there, possibly one there. The light gray area is the sampled area, so there's a certain patchiness to it. But in various ways, you can argue that small scales regularly spaced, at larger scales clustered. And those larger clusters, again, tend to be separated by sort of that typical daily travel distance. So there's a unity to these dispersed farmsteads that should be greater, you should be able to test it, than this cluster over here, in terms of a sense of typical day's movement. Also interested, go back one, Kithra's out on a limb, circled in orange there, in the northwest of Crete, to the northwest west of Crete. during the neo-palatial period, it's got strong cultural affiliations with the Minoan palace culture, if you like, of Crete. And I've been interested in trying to model some of these sort of broader geopolitics from similar perspectives. And since Evans's sort of excavation of the palace at Knossos and reconstructions of things like this so-called priest-king figure, which is, seems to be an amalgam of various wall-painting fragments put together through Evans's vision of the, what the political head of a sort of a Cretan state should look like, people have thought really over different models for how you might break up Bronze Age Crete into political units. Is it dominated from Knossos, for example? Or is it a series of different peer polities interacting with one another, as was the case in, say, Iron Age Crete? And you can model that in terms of movement. So one of the reasons I produced that cross surface of Knossos was to compare it, for example, to the linear vitae, which show little, probably provinces, administrative provinces, in a period just after the main neo-palatial, proto-palatial Minoan phases, where it does seem to be that the provinces are defined by this sense of one group of toponyms in the tablets, defining quite a close hinterland for Knossos, and then some that are clearly nearby but not quite so close, and then some that are definitely further afield in terms of the way they're dealt with. That's all terrestrial movement, but an interesting pattern with respect to Crete is the fact that over time, when we've been able to document it fully, it's only really been unified by external powers with major maritime engagement, the Romans, the Venetians, and the Ottomans, people who could unify it not on the basis of the logistics of terrestrial interaction, but because they could deploy navies that circumvented the sort of ruggedness of the Greek terrain. So if you're thinking about the Bronze Age, where we are arguing potentially for some sort of internal political power, maritime movement becomes very important. And maritime movement, if you add it into the model, however crudely, and this is very crudely, as just isotropic movement out across the sea as if it was risk-free, it certainly brings into play these external regions in a really powerful way. So this is, in hours saved, the amount of time you'd save from Knossos traveling to these external areas by maritime routes, as opposed to just terrestrial routes. So you can see that the Chania area over here, and also the far eastern side, places like Lake Astro and Satir, get incorporated far more aggressively into any sort of polity, were that polity able to differentially marshal maritime control ships. So, the tools to think, but it certainly doesn't provide an answer. Here's another interesting one, trying to use cost surfaces, where people often try and divide territories on the basis of things like decent polygons, halfway lines between different big centers to mark out territories. You can do that with respect to cost surfaces as well. But if you've got a choice between whether you model them isotropically, it doesn't matter which direction people are traveling in, or anisotropically, it does matter, it's straight out from the center sort of thing. But I think what's interesting is to do both, and then look at the difference between the two in terms of the allocations and the difference of these orange areas. And there clearly are potentially what you might call contested spaces along those zones that are probably just as interesting as any attempt to define real territories on their own. And it's interesting that some of these things, some of these sites that fall into these orange areas are quite interesting, potentially quite contested sites. So if you know the cave, the ritual cave is a good one. People have noted the very strange mixed Malian and Knossian ceramic repertoires of the site of Gournes as well. And Zomindos is a new site that's being excavated at the moment. I'll skip over this, I think, but just note that Colin Renfrew and Eric Level suggested a model some time ago for looking at hierarchical political amalgamations, so trying to look at dominance, not just the separation of territory. It was purely isotropic, as the crow flies distances. We can do better than that now, and we can choose to just look at terrestrial modeling and shape those boundaries in a sort of a terrain-sensitive way, but we can also add in things like differential access to maritime control, maritime resources, that sort of thing. It doesn't provide answers necessarily, but it allows us to cage in the possible levels of variation. Okay, so the last few things I wanted to talk about were really some potential further directions, because a lot of that is just drawing on trying to nuance our existing models of particular agents moving, how they might move, different physiological constraints, that sort of thing, but also play with cost sensors, given the new sort of technologies that are out there for managing those cost surfaces. In terms of further directions, I think one important way of looking at these things is to think more in terms of the skeletonization of landscapes, or the creation of landscape topology. It's been known for a very long time, Robert Maxwell back in 1870 suggested it, that you can divide the landscape up into a node-edge network structure that makes lots of sense. So river valleys, we call them channels, cross each other, the things you could call pits. Those pits are nodes, and river valleys are edges, networks, polylines, if you like. Ridges cross each other at peaks. The peaks are the nodes. Ridges cross channels at passes. So from the modeling of blue here, the channels, and yellow are the ridges. The modeling of something in, say, a raster model of curvature, of whether it's a channel or a ridge, you can get to a model which basically joins up the landscape into a network. Now, is that interesting beyond just pure maths? Well, in terms of the way in which people move through a landscape, particularly an unfamiliar one, the idea of something structuring it in terms of ridges and channels is very important. Think of orienteering. People often move with respect to ridge lines or channel lines, or cross them in particular ways, deliberately cutting across them at short points, across them, or use them as a set of fixed points for particular forms of navigation. So I think if we think more in these terms, we'll get one step further, and we'll talk about in a second how we can go from there, where we can go from there. At least by skeletonizing the landscape, we've got something a bit more explicit to play with. I also think that Leif's work in Bicycle was very interesting because it basically is dealing with imperfect or contingent types of network. And his example of the itinerary is a great one because it's clearly a network that's built on a particular cultural agenda. Those itineraries are being kept, recorded and kept for particular reasons. It's not anyone's movement through that Spanish landscape. It's a particular set of routes that are being preserved. And that's very important because we can then try and sort of talk about some sort of broader cultural meaning around the whole creation of a certain type of network. And the same might say for medieval pilgrimage routes and the itineraries that are still recorded in the historical literature for those periods, or the even sort of grand tours of Greece, of the sites of Greece and Rome that are recorded in sort of 17th and 19th century by Northwest Europeans. A lot of this has to do with trying to get a better idea of how individuals relate to groups, group activity, and how groups relate to social, society level instincts about movement. One of those images is here. It's worth us thinking about things like the construction of mental maps. People have imperfect ideas of landscapes through which they move. How are those imperfect ideas stored in memory, if you like? How are they shared between people? Can we model that in computational terms? How do people actually navigate? Dead reckoning, navigation by basic measurement of sort of elapsed time since the last fixed point in the landscape or last change of course, is common amongst all sorts of different animals, such as geese, a very good experiment of taking geese on a windy road and dropping on the other side of a hill and then watching to see whether they've actually retained some sense of direction. And certainly if they're able to navigate back to home base with bed reckoning. People make decisions about wayfinding through landscapes in a very rule of thumb way. For example, in a herd, people will follow, individuals will follow the tail of the animal in front. Or in human terms, you might say, well, in this unknown landscape, we'll always take the high road, we'll always take the low road. So those kind of heuristics, those are imperfect decision-making. Decision-making in an imperfect world is very important. And a great one on the top right there is a sort of very situated perspective of people from, if you're thinking about movement scenarios, it's not top-down like those cost surfaces. People are situated when they move, and they do so in a very perspectivized way. the New Yorker capture, sort of, if you were thinking about travel across the states and you were living in Manhattan, have an extremely sort of skewed view of the world, and particularly sort of New York and cultured one. And lastly, really, I just want to talk about multi-agent simulation, because I think this is a very important way in which you can bring together a lot of these strands, which is that multi-agent simulation tries to model behavior of individual software agents, if you like. In that sense, it's a lot closer to trying to model humans than something like a cost surface, because you can give them a set of imperfect behaviors and see how they react. You can also tell them to interact with other agents, and therefore there is a sort of a social glue to the whole model, potentially. Those agents can retain some sort of incomplete spatial awareness. They can have little maps of the world themselves that are imperfect or limited in terms of their scope, their extent. And they can, in theory, trade those to other people. So there's sort of information sharing going on. And some of the best work in this regard is done by Mark Blake, looking at mesolithic colonization, actually looking for patterns associated with microliths and hazelnuts. Can you explain the observed record in the archaeology of microlith distributions across the island of Islay on the basis of foraging patterns out from a founder population in the south of the island looking for a particular resource, hazelnuts. And those foragers were agents in the computer, and they had little mental maps of their local area, and they tried to trade them with one another to get a good idea of hazelnut resources on the island from that start point. The fact that the model actually doesn't confirm that hazelnuts are the sort of key resource in that respect is sort of almost beside the point. So lastly, how does classical archaeology and classics sort of fit into this potential for computational modeling moving? Well, the great thing is actually, in relative terms, just think of other areas of the world, the ancient world sort of offers very strong control over sort of possible paleo landscapes and movement networks, things like Roman roads. So that's fairly unusual. There's certain other environments like that, but not that many. Very good sort of documentary evidence of the logistics of human and animal movement, which can be played off any sort of computational modeling. Good understanding of various assisted movement technology, boats, for example, carts, wheeled vehicles of various sorts. got some feeling for when people exchange information about movement, routing through landscapes, that sort of thing, or political territories. At what moments do people define those parameters for one another? What kind of social and cultural context? Some nice differences potentially between certain types of directional movement, big, massive bilateral trading agreements or sort of political embassies or postal services or whatever, and ones that are a little bit sort of more messy in their rhythms, things like potential tramping trade around the Eastern Mediterranean, Mediterranean in general. And those are interesting differences. And further different agendas as well. We might talk about agendas such as broader geopolitical ones, perhaps funneled through the Roman army versus various other local agendas. So I don't think any other part of the world period of history really offers that potential range. So definitely a lot of opportunity. Thank you.
Questions?
That was really interesting. Thank you very much. Whereas you said at the beginning that it was only the beginning, it's actually a really great beginning because it's summarized, it's put together so many things for us. My question is going to be about visualization, because you've spoken about continuous movement and also movement in nodes. Have you looked at all at any of the types of visualization that have been done, whether it's continuous visualization across terrain somehow, or whether or not it's out in terms of nodes and iterated in that way?
You mean human visual perception from particular points in the landscape, or?
Well, maybe spreading of people or traveling along particular routes, because at the moment all of those images are static, and you're looking at it in a
I mean, a lot of people have played a lot with looking at either existing routes or proposed routes and saying, well, is there structure in terms of changing usually visual perception along those routes? Whether that has meaning such as opening out to a much wider perspective on the landscape at a particular point or closing off again.
So in terms of risk and territory and battle.
But there's a lot more that can be done. It's really, that sort of thing's pretty much on the edge of the computational sort of, computers are getting fast enough now that they can deal with the computations necessary, but it's still a little bit on the edge. You'd want to, some of the things you want to look at, for example, I'm very interested in the potential, on the Greek island I now work on, there's a lot of piracy, and it'd be interesting to look at points in the landscape where you could view things, but they couldn't view you, and you'd like to be able to map that for the whole island and for neighbouring islands and for the seascape as well. And that's something you might be able to run on a sort of a distributed grid computer, but you couldn't run it on a PC. So some of that's probably logistical still in terms of why people aren't doing so much.
Good question about relationships between different networks and systems that you look at in this way. By the way, I thought it was really, really interesting the way you can express these things through movement. But I mean, to take for example about the expansion of the Muslim state in the inflation period, for example, I mean, what about things going on at that time which are spatially similar yet conceptually very different, like for example the network of sanctuaries at the time. I mean, there was a theory that political dominance came out of involvement in cults of these sanctuaries and so forth. And I know there have been stuff coming out recently questioning the idea that invisibility between peak sanctuaries is actually as important as we used to think. I mean, if you've got two apparently quite separate, quantitatively separate things like that, how do you handle crossovers?
With things like visibility analysis and...
Yes. I mean,
some of the... one of last year's MSc and GIS students at UCL did quite an interesting study of the peak sanctuaries from a viewshed perspective, but also took some of the better data for Knossos Yuktas and also for Astypalia, proto-palatial, slightly lower level, less fancy peak sanctuary, and tried to look at routing up from lowland settlement areas and how viewsheds might change on those potential routes, some more or less certain in terms of whether they're real routes or not. So I think a lot of, as you were both suggesting, a lot of the sort of potential is actually integrating those two rather than keeping them separate. Because they're not really, since Gibson and others have always said they're not separate. Their perception is a mobile experience and visual perception is too.
Have you looked at using game engines at all?
Looking at game engines?
Some of them would be set up to be one of those things, some sort of visualization that presumably you can pull back to wireframe, but also networks and agents in the natural system.
They would be, I mean, they clearly have been trying to push that, how do you say, optimize that sort of processing of situated perspectives, sort of shooter perspectives essentially, for a long time. The only query I'd have would be, how to put that within some sort of formalized inferential setup, i.e. what would you be trying to understand and how would you know when you've understood it and prove that you've understood it, you know what I mean? I mean, I think it'd be good, it's a good tool again to think with, but in terms of, it would lead to some interesting questions, but I wouldn't know myself how to confirm them, you know what I mean, yet. That's true of VR as well, really, that it's still out there as to how you actually use it in a sort of confirmatory way for research.
And that gets back to where you're looking at the contested spaces, the isotropic and anisotropic. I mean, that seems really interesting, but that's just by chance that these are the contested areas, or whether that's... Because if you're saying it takes longer to move in one direction than in the other, is it the case that it sometimes there's not, and that's why they become the contested areas? Do you have an idea of why those two measurements?
Well, I mean, I could just say it's pure fuzziness in the computation. I mean, between whether you're using an anisotropic module or an isotropic one, but I think it's probably a bit more than that, in the sense of anisotropic movement is assuming you're moving out from the center, out to the edge, and that's a certain sort of cultural, logistical scenario. Your response, for example, to a message that you need to move to the border of a territory and do something. So I put it on quite a sort of high sort of strategic level, if you know what I mean, a response to some border dispute from the center. But most of life within those spaces is not going to operate in that sort of way, I would think. It's going to operate, it's going to be cross-cut, it's going to be that, what sort of Gordon and Bissell would call sort of Brownian motion of people, you know, heading in different directions. And that's maybe better modeled isotropically. So the difference between those two different agendas may be part of the way of explaining those contested areas.
But the element, I guess, when they're of how people perceive distance as well, right? I mean, if I can see that ridge from my capital, even though it takes me 8 hours to get there,
mm-hmm.
it still feels like that should be part of my territory. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be aspects of
yeah, that's the extra one you want to add in, is sort of visual territory, which is obviously frustratingly out there. I mean, even if you can monitor it, you can't get to it, there's still a problem, but there's another layer of those two. Yeah.
I think it links in excellently with this final slide of yours, the role of classics and so forth, and this idea of what constitutes a place, what constitutes a point in the map. I mean, you know, Thucydides never talks about Athens, he talks about the Athenians, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, that the place is the people, and it's wherever the people happen to be, even when they get driven out of the physical place of Athens, those wars. So I think, you know, it's almost rethinking this, what we refer to as this God's eye view of a map, which, you know, neatly divided up into coloured segments, which also is history that's taught.
And it's not true, I mean, I think I agree with a lot of the criticisms of these approaches in terms of them being a little bit naive in the past. You know, God's idea is one example. But I don't think that there's something inherently that way, in terms of, people often point at the fundamental binary, you know, operation of computers is driving this, but I don't think that's true at all. It's a lack of ingenuity, really.
Just a point of information, since you talked about pre-computing just now, there is a project just starting up in Birmingham, which is aiming to do exactly that. It's
mm-hmm.
a reconstruction of Battle of Madison.
Oh, great.
Using parallel computing.
Yeah, that'd be very interesting. Yeah. There is a distributed computing network within London, but I've never dared to try and set up for this.
It's actually the note that all the other colleges want to use. So.
Oh, right.
Of course, one of the fascinating things is the people travel no more than 1 hour a day on different cultures, different places. I think I would probably start off, or want to start off, if I want to see what the normal pattern of things are happening, I'd want to start off in, if I knew an area, discussing an area, I want to start off and say, how many people at a particular, how many people lived there at that particular time? And then, I mean, this is so naive. And then I say to myself, well, if that's true, then obviously not everybody can be moving it all the time. And probably if the normal community is to go on in that area, it must be something like, what should we say, 5% of people moving every day? Otherwise, all the things that have to be done can't get done in these areas. So that would give me a sense of the maximum number of people could be traveling, and presumably the frequency of which routes are. Which in turn would give you a sense of, if it was a large area, people couldn't travel across it in a single day, that there would have to be some intermediate points at which they could either refresh themselves and their animals, or get, so which would imply in that case, obviously, that there's some kind of exchange that they could do to, and all those kind of things. But that's so naive, that, you know, that's insulting.
I think that's really important, is that there, you know, there's slices of the population that are doing different types of movement and moving to very varying degrees, and that's very much affecting their worldviews all the time. And I think I'm sure there are ways of breaking down. You take a particular society and you say, well, you can perceive these people are going to have certain sorts of short-range movement, which is going to be dominant, these other people are going to do things differently. And I don't think as like proves anything, but trying to grapple with political geography in Crete, very clear that the linkages at the top level, as you probably expect, it's not so rocket science. The elite goods are expressing a level of spatial integration, which means that those people are moving much longer distances more regularly than the general populace. So
exchanging something to be important. Exchanging the elite goods.
Yeah, that's right. Probably both of those, I'd suggest. Yeah. But yeah. It's just picking out what those groups are for modeling purposes.
Yeah.
It seems like using GPS tracking for humans or animals especially, you get a lot more fine-grained view of what the actual decisions are, what the times are between any two points and even intermediate points along the path. Has there been any data collection in that? That
work by Nico Trifovich in Peru is absolutely excellent and so cheap. So a piece of research is one season in Peru tracking a set of lion caravans, and the data's better data than I've seen anywhere else on sort of patterns of movement. All of the sort of interesting qualitative things about scale of different caravans, their agendas, where they stopped, that sort of thing, but also just really good numbers on, you know, how fast they travel over different slopes, rest periods, that sort of thing.
What are they carrying, the llamas?
Various trade goods. I don't think it's huge amounts of sort of weight, sort of tens of 60 kilograms, 50 kilograms, I think. But I mean, their baggage camels can carry a lot more, but they're all the same sort of family. But the temptation is to transfer the model of the llamas, because they've got the similar foot shapes and things, to the camels in the sort of old world. Their differences as well.
Do you know if anyone's looked at the yaks in Nepal and the trails in Nepal? Because then you've got a very there's only the valleys of the paths up the mountains, and there's nothing else. There's no roads anymore.
I mean, I'm so totally ignorant about it. I mean, are they used also as traction animals or?
They do. They come down in the winter, and the men travel with the yaks and take all the salts and things like that, and up in the high valley. I've been there drinking. It's a salt trail. They used to trade in salt, going back years, and we saw them coming through with all the yaks laden up, and there were lots of other things on the yaks as well, like blankets and things that they're selling and trading. But they move down from the high mountains across, and so during the winter, and then move back up into the high mountains during the summer.
What
would
the size of the group?
Maybe there were 10 or 15 men and many more yaks carrying things. I mean, I can think of a couple of occasions where we crossed them as we were walking, but it was fairly high up still. Yeah. I mean, my memory of it is that it's along a ridge, and so the ridge is fairly open, and the yaks are spreading across the ridge, but they must have to go through.
No.
They're not tied at all. They're completely wandering, but they're with the people. And they would have had to go through the same narrow paths as we have to go through now. And I think even if you see that film from the land, you'll see the yaks come down those paths which are made in the same area. And on a couple of occasions in Camp Zombie where there were many more yaks, you tend to keep away from them then because they're very big and there's lots of them. But they were certainly used for trading. They have these basically bags that are put on either side of the yak with salt and with everything. They're very heavy and they're very large beasts.
So the salt goes one way, what comes the other way?
No, I can't tell you. I can't. I probably read about it afterwards, but that was a number of years ago. Because the interest was after actually seeing them on route, there was a lot of interest in one and they did, but I believe it's not a salt trap.
The anthropological question which strikes me, which I'm sure some of these people that have thought about is if you can track someone to that difference, you know, where they're travelling hour to hour over the course of a whole journey, such as, you know, in the Andes or wherever, can you trace differences between the kinds of decisions they make when they reach peaks? valleys and various other things, if they're taking the known route, or if they're having to work it out as they go along. So I mean, that was something you touched on. That's something you could certainly do anthropological field work on that, couldn't you?
Yeah, I could. People have tried it in more structured environments, such as orienteering competitions.
Mm-hmm.
But I know somebody who was just visiting from Quebec, who was looking at trying to model Neanderthal colonization episodes into Europe. So entirely unfamiliar environments, with the assumption that they have particular logics, if you like, for moving into those environments, rules of thumb, some decision making. And I'm not sure it's got sort of crux of it yet, but she has a strong interest in orienteering.
Mm-hmm.
So what sort of strategies might they have in terms of what she would call landscape legibility markers? Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's a sort of important distinction between known landscapes and unknown ones, and part of the really interesting thing is the in-between, when knowledge is being built up, and how that happens, and I like that. So a science paper or nature paper, something which is the evolution of trackways, is it something which is deliberate? This is accumulating knowledge which is somehow pooled in some formal way, or is it just emerge out of the sort of the signs you leave as you move? Because of course, there's been quite a lot of work on ant navigation to food sources, and ant navigation is very much on the basis of the residues of pheromone residues.
Like landscapes as cultural things, how you investigate that, like you would investigate any other kind of cultural thing, human relationship to landscape.
Some of those impacts are more permanent than others. Some
yes.
of them are we'll still observe now in the archaeological records. Some.
Anything else?
Well, what would be longest distance for a spiritual pilgrimage be in the classical world? That's just an idea, I don't know.
I don't know, that's good. I'm trying to think of pilgrimages in the classical world.
It's a very difficult term to define, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because if you travel somewhere in order to visit a sacred site, is that automatically a pilgrimage?
Or a holiday away from the life, yes.
Well, right, yeah. Pilgrimage and sightseeing, I think,
in the medieval period, I guess people are moving right the length of the Mediterranean to Mecca.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, you have people travelling to consult oracles, which is quite a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
But classical literature is full of that.
Yeah. So you have to know that there's something there for you. Yeah.
But again, that's place specific. So.
Yeah. Well, all counts of the geographically located, so to speak.
Well, you don't buy it.
No, no, I know. Yeah, no.
So it is actually a place of a temple.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose one way of again taking this further would be to look at literary expressions of space in that way. Because classical literature is full of space. That's not so much expression of journey in the real world, but the literary device can still be expressed in relation to geography.
I think that there's a really interesting mismatch there between people tended to go for either the literary descriptions of movement past and through a place as being right or being wrong. Got very upset when there is a mismatch. You know, it must be some sort of really generic and sort of poorly represented description, or it must be observer truth. But of course, these are situated mobile people as they move past these places. And Kithra is actually a really good example, because all the way through sort of rediscovery by Europeans of Kithra from, say, the 16th century on through to the 19th century AD, these are people who think of Kithra as the birthplace of Aphrodite. And they're expecting this lush, wonderful place. And we know archaeologically and historically that it's doing pretty well for itself in agricultural terms, the population, at least by the sort of 18th century. But the descriptions are so mismatching with that. They sort of say, well, we couldn't find anyone, it's barren. And of course, they were hitting two places on the island. They were hitting one main town, and then they were probably going to see the ruins. and the ruins happen to be in an area that doesn't go into the agricultural hinterland, and it's all rocky looking. So these were very situated Europeans passing in particular routes and not getting a sort of God's eye view of it, which you should be able to model computationally as well, because you could predict which routes they take.
Some of the ancient world was populated with people who didn't actually stay in one place all the time. They were migratory, and following animals and that kind of stuff. Have you got people doing work on that sort of thing?
Not really, although a current student wants to work on Anatolian patterns of sort of interaction, part of which relates to pastoral element, pastoralist element.
Does the 1 hour travel thing include nomadic peoples?
That's a good question. I suspect it might be sedentary peoples.
Right.
I don't know, but
I mean, presumably nomads can't travel all day, every day either. What to do?
No, but I would have thought they potentially travel. But I suspect that's probably been to sedentary groups. But, if you want the Greek modern situation, is one of the ones that was the important point of comparison for looking at Tokyo travel times in the 20th century versus Greek village travel time.
Yeah, that kind of looks back to the expressions of time within spatial context. I was actually thinking you were putting that example up. I read somewhere that Greek villages sometimes express distance in cigarettes. Yes, that village is 5 cigarettes away. You can smoke 5 cigarettes in the time it takes to get there. Whether that's true or not.
To assume a constant, it has to be chain smoking.
Yes, it sounds true of Greece.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's 5 cigarettes, but only 2 for Bill.
Yes.
So the people who chew gat and all those sort of things, they have a number of tubes for mouthfuls.
Yeah, probably.
Anyway, I think I'm going to wrap things up here, although that's not really the end. There's still plenty of wine, but I think that's the end of the formal, relatively formal bit of the seminar. So thank you again very much.
Yeah.
I forgot, by the way, to advertise next week's seminar, which is by Francis Foster of King's, a digital presentation of text and service. So you, or if you're interested in that, please come along, and that's here.